This is the third ACC lecture of the 17th ACC, and this is February the 27th, 1957. A man is as well off as he can consider himself dangerous to his environment. That doesn't say that a person who considers himself dangerous to his environment is well off. But it does say that he is as well off as he can consider himself dangerous to his environment. In other words, he is able to assume this condition. And if you cannot assume that condition, then need some process. It's quite interesting. I'll tell you a little short anecdote that's quite amusing. Was very, very amusing to me. In the service, as you know, they treat people like, in their training, as though they should become a deadly killer of some sort or another, and that's very true of judo. And didn't matter much what branch of the service you were in, sooner or later somebody got hold of you and taught you some judo. Well, this combined with frontier fighting, which I had learned something of when I was a little boy and so had managed to live through a frontier area, made a combination of defensive and offensive actions which could prove useful if one ever found himself in the infantry. But of course, no man in his right mind would ever find himself in the infantry. If he found himself in the infantry, he would know at once he was not in his right mind. But here we have a set of trained, you wouldn't say trained responses, but trained awarenesses in physical combat with other people. Well, sometime early in 1945, I flunked my overseas examination. In other words, I'd come into the country, and when I was about to leave again, they told me they had enough people around, and that now they were examining people to find out whether or not they're physically fit for they're sending them overseas. And they took a look at my service record and said, "Oh my God," and two or three doctors fainted and sent me up to the captain of the dispensary, and he argued with me, and I argued, and we had a bad time, and they finally laid foul hands upon me and threw me in an ambulance and sent me to a hospital. Well, in view of the fact I was in much better condition in early 1945 than I'd been in 1942 physically, this was quite a ridiculous action, but by that time they had some people around to occupy a few posts. But this made me feel very bad. It made me feel very bad. I was all set to go back overseas, and I had my post, and so on, and here I found myself in hospital, and that's a very lowering level of morale. And that's what was wrong with me, more than anything else. Oh, I had a couple of wounds that wouldn't heal, and so on, minor nonsense, I couldn't see. But they nevertheless insisted that the war was over. Well, I crawled around, and I felt sorry for myself. And the fact of it was that the judo instructor there at the hospital said, "Well, they'll have you out of here and send you overseas again because you'll be getting better." And he was brought up on the idea there was a shortage of people in the war. There was. There was no shortage of people on bases at home, but there was a terrible shortage of people in the war. And so he kept up my training for me. We used to get a mat and flop around in the yard alongside of the ward. And I think it was July the 25th, I went down to Hollywood, and three sailors with petty officers' ratings accosted me on the street. It was evening. They were drunk. They took a look at my campaign ribbons and sneered, and went through a remarkable state of this and that, since I had said really nothing to them to amount to anything. They were out to kill officers. They were not really petty officers, but they were mechanics who had been so raided and were serving at a repair base. And the three of them tied into me. And I astonished myself. This isn't talking about my prowess. This is talking about morale. an unbelievable thing happened. One of them turned me around to face him, while a second one took a heavy beer bottle to bring it down on my skull. And I took the fellow who brought the beer bottle down and got the beer bottle arm here, broke it, threw him over my head into this fellow who went down and hit the side of a bumper. The beer bottle hit the pavement, broke the end off, and the other fellow reared up where he'd been sitting on the running board of a car, and I put it in his state. That's what you're trained to do. Now, this is rather boring English than what somebody did beating up somebody else, but this really has points. It has tremendous points, as far as you're concerned. Sure had one with me. It's big subjective reality. Overnight, the wounds in my side healed. Overnight. I was walking on air. I was still in the hospital. They wouldn't let me out. They'd surveyed me for retirement. They wouldn't let me out at all, but I could get extended leave from the hospital. In other words, I still had to be on duty at the hospital. I went down to Hollywood, messed around the studios, pushed everybody's face in. Very aggressive. Made a whale of a comeback by the time the war was over. Boy, I was roaring on my old career. In the middle of all that, I managed to complete all the researches which I'd stacked up and which had been interrupted by the war. Steam. Where'd it come from? Well, you get knocked around often enough by, quote, superior officers, unquote. You get knocked around often enough by the enemy and defeated. Because I started the war on a defeat, the Asiatic fleet. You get your teeth shoved in this way and that, and you develop a tremendous amount of inflow, which everyone tells you you're not supposed to outflow. And you, being a social animal, check that outflow. And you hold in, with all of that checked outflow, all of the things that have been done to you. And then one day, you just outflow, exclamation point. Bang. Not necessarily in the line of murder, because actually at a court-martial later on, where they court-martialed these sailors, they had killed an officer and had put two more in the hospital, same boys. The court-martial board would not believe that I had not been helped. I was very amused about this. Chief Petty Officer would not believe that I had not been assisted somehow or another. When the sailors walked in, muchly assisted, into the station after a shore patrol had arrived, the chief petty officer in charge of the shore patrol, who had been sitting at his desk, started telling me about these men, and he said, under no circumstances should you have taken any action against them at all, because they've already killed an officer and they put two more in the hospital. And you were trifling with your life, and he was going on, and he was telling me what a good boy I ought to be. You should be a good boy. And then, through the door, he saw the shore patrolman bring these people in. Of course, they were all saturated with blood, and they were all messed up. And he just shut up right then. Well, what was he doing? He was running the usual social dramatization. You must protect yourself, sir. We teach our kids, you must protect yourself. Don't outflow. Defend. And someday you break the dikes and outflow. Boom! Now, you don't have to do it in the form of violence and half kill somebody. I'm sure there are people present who can do that much and much more with judo. But one day you say, once I could write some poetry, and I just don't do it anymore. And one day you say, I'm going to write some, come hell or high water, I'm going to write this, and I'm going to get it straightened out. And you do that. You do outflow. You feel different. And one day you say, well, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. And you say, well, I'm going to do it in spite of hell. And you do it, and all of a sudden you feel better. Well, this is a social balancing of flaws. The society teaches you to hold in. A gentleman is today classified as one who is restrained. He has good manners. I don't know where the word gentle came from, except maybe from gentlemen, because the earliest gentlemen I had any recollection of on this planet certainly weren't gentle. They were specialists in outflow. They went around all the time trying to find out some direction to do something. We talked to each other and all of a sudden wanted to miss a verb or something, and they want to argue it a little bit on the field of honor. We're very outflow happy. They're more or less above the law. They weren't tremendously restrained. Nobody dared do anything to them. These men did some of the most fantastic things in battle and across the world. Nobody can do those things today. Why? It's simply a matter that somebody was not quite as inhibited, not quite as prevented from outflowing. All you actually have to do to somebody is to prevent him from outflowing, to make him ill. And someday, by natural consequences, he decides to outflow, and he feels better. Sometimes when he outflows, he realizes that he has not outflowed against a legitimate target, which makes him regret having outflowed. A man beats up a girl. That's not a legitimate target. He recognizes that it's no triumph on his part. It isn't social mores, it's just the fact that it is not a competent opponent. And no glory attaches there too. He recognizes that this is something he should not have done. So he takes the inertia of the outflowing blows and uses that to pull the incident in and stick it. He withholds the incident. So not only the social world, but the world of yourself can act to cause you to prevent outflow. Outflow is prevented by regret. It's prevented by all sorts of things. But amongst the most important things is value. Valuableness. If one has something terrifically valuable, he protects it, which is what? Prevent an inflow. Well, when you say prevent an inflow, you might as well say prevent an outflow. If you hold flows from coming in towards you, you might as well haul some in. Because sooner or later, that dike that you put up is going to burst. So you get these compounded actions in this universe composing a picture of tremendous inflow, not balanced at all by outflow. And one day against a legitimate opponent or in a worthwhile activity, you do manage to outflow. You manage to be on the job. You manage to be right there with spark and fire in your eye and do that thing. Immediately after, you feel tremendous. I did measure up to it. That's something I did. But actually what you're talking about is I could outflow. It was possible for me to do that. Thus, in great emergencies, people appear to have much more power and strength. They just start into this, and there's nothing preventing them from exerting this power and strength, and so they are capable then of enormous actions which they would not otherwise be capable of. Sometimes a man finds himself dying. He realizes it's inopportune. It wasn't by his consent. Body is kicking off. And here he is, poor little old weak Satan that just couldn't disturb a match on the table, you know. And he wraps a beam around the body and he says, He never suspected himself of being capable of that much power. Very often Satan does things like this and says, you know, I'm not lost after all. I'm not completely gone. Only trouble is he's liable to hang on to these things as tremendous victories. Because they're big victories and they're few and far between in this society. So, what does this all add up to? Adds up to the fact that a person must be able to outflow or even inflow at will in order to be in very good shape. If a person is dangerous to a dangerous environment, he, of course, measures up to it. He is capable in it because he is not protecting. Any time that you protect and defend, you are aiding and abetting all of the structures which make up this universe. Any time you are defending, any time you are protecting, you are aiding and abetting the structures of this universe. You can defend yourself to death very easily. Now, it may be true that teaching school children to avoid automobiles does cut down the number of accidents, but maybe that's just for now. Maybe it's a short-term look, like patching up a broken leg is a short-term way of handling a broken leg. We do patch up broken legs, but it's a cinch that the fact that we patched it up and changed it and altered it and thus laid in some sort of a picture which continued, that fact alone had to be done at the time, does give a continuance of fatality. Now, the child who is taught to defend himself or defend other children against these big, ferocious, vicious automobiles someday turns out to be one of the lousiest drivers you ever saw. And we don't know at what age, but he loses control of automation in one way or another. Why? Because he's taught to defend and protect. He's taught to put up screens. He's taught that he has to go through a certain regimen in order to accomplish safety. But the fact that safety is desirable gives us the whole panorama of fatality. All you have to assume is that safety is desirable to have all of the ills of Pandora's box form around your head. Therefore, if someone starts running from nothing, becomes convinced there's a reason for his running, and after a while creates something to run from, which is quite the most remarkable sequence of events you ever cared to examine. This, by the way, is an old question that was posed in early pre-Marxist Leipzig psychology. Is, does a man become afraid because he runs, or does he run because he's afraid? And they used to offer this, William James and some of the others before psychology was all turned over to the commies. They used to offer this as one of the great conundrums of mental activity. And we can come up with the answer to this today. A man becomes afraid because he runs. That is true. Sometime or another on the track, he had to get the idea that running away and fear were synonymous. He had to plot this all out for himself. He had to postulate that something was dangerous enough to be run from. And you see, amongst all the idiocies that a Thetan adopts, this is the most idiotic. Just what boxing glove can hit a Thetan, I would not know. Just what bullet can penetrate a Thetan hasn't been invented yet. Otherwise, the Catholic Church long since would have used it. A Thetan has to mock himself up to be reachable.
He has to mock up his own beingness in such a way as to contact with some other beingness which can be struck in order to feel any pain or any reaction or any effect. It's quite remarkable. Any psychosomatic ill which a person has is being held there by himself and by nothing else. Because the thing he is defending against is no longer there, but he has erected pictures and pressures so that it can seem to be continued. And thus we get one of the facets of why pictures are pictures. But here we have an oddity. Somebody has a pain in his shoulder. Well, that is genius at work. The body is incapable of feeling a pain in its shoulder. But a thetan can have a ridge that will adjust to the degree that the body is misadjusted, which will then deliver to him the sensation of pain. You talk about vias. These are fabulous. How a thetan has a stomachache is quite wonderful. And I investigated this matter of stomachaches one time and found out that most people have stomachaches elsewhere than in their stomachs. And some thetans get so misaligned that they have stomachaches 2 and 3 feet out in front of the body, and some have stomachaches in their knees, and some have stomachaches way behind their back. You ask them to actually find out where their stomach is hurting, which is not a question that would ordinarily be asked socially. You might ask him, where does it hurt? And he puts a hand nebulously on his midriff. But you ask him to establish very accurately, and you were very insistent in asking him to establish this very accurately, where the stomach is aching. And he will search around, and he'll normally discover that his stomach is not aching where his stomach is. And that is very peculiar. Headaches cured by anacin become an additional miracle. How you can do something chemically to the body, which then does something chemically to the ridges and other superstructures, which then cuts off a pain which a fellow turned on, is quite remarkable. You take an anacin, and you have taken something then that cancels something you were doing. In other words, to take medicine is to make yourself rather totally ineffective. Quite interesting, fascinating, to behold the mislocations and miscalculations of a thetan with regard to pain. Now, you possibly have never surveyed this to any degree, but people's idea of pain from person to person is one of the most variable things there is. It's terribly variable because there's no standard. Very few people can find out how much any other person hurts. So it is enough for mama to go around hurting for the child later on to assume that it hurts. Mama goes around hurting and saying that she is hurting, and she puts on such a remarkably dramatic show of hurting that the child gets a terrifically exaggerated idea of how much hurting is. And pain is therefore pain exclamation point. Now, somebody comes along and tells him it won't hurt. Somebody comes along and tells him that the pain will go away. Somebody tries to reassure him one way or the other. It's an oddity that they are never talking against a known commodity. The intensity of pain is not a known commodity to any other person than the person who is suffering it, for the good reason that a body cannot feel pain, and pain has to be tailor-made and manufactured individually and moment by moment and stored up in the bank in order to be even vaguely effective upon the individual. And thus you can get a tremendous variance in how hurtful is hurt. Now, with that in mind, you can graduate the scale from no pain down to feeling pain down to an anesthesia against pain. This at no moment tells you, though, how much pain or how much anesthesia. It tells you various points on the tone scale, but it doesn't tell you the intensity of those points. So don't be at all amazed to have somebody have a small bump on his head and have him feel that the entirety of Earth is lying there, crushing him in, and somebody else to have a fractured skull and not be bothered by it. See, how much is much, and how little is little, is not an easily answered question at all. In other words, we are not dealing with a standard issue machine. And your first action in undertaking healing is to understand that you are not treating a machine. You're treating a mock-up, which is trying to approximate a machine according to its own ideas of what the machine is. And that's a wild variable. Therefore, somebody tells you that some little thing hurts, it hurts like mad and so on. Don't bother to compare it to your own idea how much pain is. Just know that there's a variable in the matter. He hurts. He's in terrible pain. He's in agony. He can't stand it. He's liable to go frantic at any instant. Fact of the matter is, possibly he is. Maybe he's got a hangnail. He's been given to understand that on the appearance of a hangnail, he is now supposed to hurt like hell. You see? That's his understanding of the situation. Somebody else has a hangnail, and his now I'm supposed to record is to feel annoyed. Difference of intensity, no difference of position on the tone scale. Now, if you were to directly attack this problem, first thing you would have to take in mind is the person's own protective ideas. How much he had to defend, how much he had to protect. That would be one of the first things you, not necessarily treating it, would actually look at with regard to a person. How much is this person defending himself? Now, many people will become very defensive at no overt action on your part at all, and this again marks a point on the tone scale, and is more directly on the tone scale than intensity of pain. We make a little gesture toward somebody and he flinches. We give a BB gun to one man and he fires it and kicks. And he says, "Wow, that's terrible. Awful jolt that gun has." And we give a 12-gauge shotgun to another fella and he fires it and he says, "Boy, so that's a light weapon." Mechanically, each experienced the same mechanical reaction. You understand? Each experienced the same mechanical reaction. The 12-gauge gun did drive back against his shoulder as hard as 12-gauge guns drive back against shoulders. The BB gun did drive back just as tinily as BB guns do. In each case. But his idea of what he was supposed to feel at that time was entirely different. So you're dealing with the idea of what a person is supposed to feel as a result of when it comes to influence. It's what he's supposed to feel as a result of. And that's just an idea. And he's never compared this idea well or easily. And as a result, you can never depend upon what the free clear says about what's wrong with you. You really can't. Free clear tells you he has a very serious stomach condition. You have to look him over and you'll very often be quite surprised to find out that he has a hole in his head. But as far as his stomach is concerned, it's something so minor that a small dose of bicarbonate of soda would have taken care of it at any moment during the last 20 years. But pains in the stomach are tremendous. The pains in the head can be neglected. There's his, now I'm supposed to, complication. Don't you see? He has different ideas about what's wrong with him from person to person. His evaluation of any given situation
changes and varies, and these are not constants. Therefore, you needn't put much trust in them.
How much he has to defend himself will, however, result in a direct mechanical action. And this you can measure because that is constant. If a person over-defends himself through some exaggerated idea of pain, he will suffer the full consequences of that over-defense just to the degree that anybody else over-defends himself to that degree. You understand? So the reason for the defense or the reason for safety is variable, but the consequences of it aren't. How he regards the amount of pain he is feeling is variable, but the actual mechanical situation causing the pain is not variable.
You are dealing with the constancies, then, of the solid agreements of MEST. And as long as you deal with masses and agreements and ideas directly concerning masses, you're all right. But when you go back into an opinion of what it ought to be, as far as the pre-clear is concerned, you're, of course, immediately in trouble. And yet a Thetan is far more willing to look at ideas than he is masses. And therefore, any auditor that's having a rough time with pre-clears, it's not snapping him out of the hop immediately, is paying attention to this factor I've talked about, which is a variable, which is opinion, 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 figure, 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 ideas, ideas, ideas. They're not reliable. They shift from person to person. Naturally, all you've got to do is change the person's mind. But that is not an open sesame to process his ideas. Yes, all you have to do is change his mind about the way it all is, and you will change the person. Yeah, that's true. But is there any constant entrance point at that point? Well, there doesn't seem to be. You can change the ideas of mass. You can change his ideas via mass. You can change his ideas of location, space, boundness, these other things. And you get a solid operating ground under which he can now evaluate what is happening. Here we have a stove. One preclear has an idea of the stove that it's the most dangerous thing in the world. He's been burned by it, or he's not been burned by it. He just has an idea that it's a dangerous item. That if he touched the stove, it would cause him a great deal of pain. We have another preclear who has an idea the stove should all be destroyed. Remember, though, we have only a stove. But we have two different ideas about the same stove. Now, if we processed preclear A's ideas about the stove only, but didn't process the stove, I'm afraid we wouldn't get a true estimate of a stove. We would simply get more miscalculations on his part. Why? He has yet to directly experience a stove. Preclear B has various ideas about this stove. We process Preclear B's ideas and figure figures and his supposed to us and how his grandfather said all of these kind of things about this stove, but never directly addressed him to the stove. We would then get simply miscalculations on top of miscalculations, because the truth of the matter would never occur to him. If he directly confronts the stove, whether he's preclear A or B, the idea will sooner or later occur to him that stoves are stoves. And that he could throw himself in with the coal and not experience any harmful effect. He can't throw a body in with the coal. That's what he thinks he'd have to do. In other words, if we restrain the observation of A and the observation of B, we then can get A and B to miscalculate and overreach and underreach the truth of the matter about stoves. Got it? If we can keep them from directly observing stoves, we will then give them enormous variable ideas about stoves. You see that?
If they communicate directly with the stove, however, which is just the stove,
they'll get over all these ideas, because a stove is just a stove. It isn't anything else. So it is actually necessary for us to give a person the idea of danger from the stove before the person can then get a miscalculation about the stove. Chew that one over for a moment, would you? Do you see that clearly? Restraining an observation of, an experience of the stove, preventing it in some fashion, is cutting communication. And only when that communication has been cut can a great many miscalculations come aborning. Now, supposing we had no cops in the society, but there was the idea around that there were cops, you would get some of the nuttiest ideas you have ever heard of. People would talk about cops and be very authoritative about cops and what the law was or wasn't and so forth. And if this went on very long, this continued belief that there were police, but nobody ever communicating with any police, you would have a set of ideas about cops different for each person in the entire community. Why? Because there's no way to experience cops. Cops are an idea with which one cannot go into communication. Therefore, we get this great oddity, abundance and scarcity, as given in 8008. Remedy the abundance and scarcity in all things. Very important. Only it isn't actually the possession of quantity. It is only apparently quantitative. It is having something to go into communication with. And when a person does not have enough things to go into communication with of a certain size, shape, and general description, then he can enter into trouble about them. A stove then becomes something else where one does not have enough stoves. A stove can become all sorts of different things to all sorts of different people, because there is no way they can get into a common agreement on this, and they make up their own minds and build their own universes of stoves. And these can get so wild that communication on the subject becomes impossible, and they have the appearance of protecting themselves against something. I am very sure that the whole world of disease is built entirely on this mechanism. I seriously doubt the existence of any given germ. Seriously doubt it. Give you an example. I made a very careful analysis, by the way, of, this is a very unpleasant subject, but becomes a very interested subject to a leader of expeditions, because he goes into strange ports and various things, and he has to keep his crew well, and that is venereal disease. And why this is any different than any other kind of disease, I'll never be able to understand, unless it's been blessed by Venus or something, has religious rites connected with it, whereas pneumonia doesn't. But it makes a man just about the same sickness. It's just about the same breed of cat, and these days is just as all same handled as anything else. But I found out something very odd. That I had cases of venereal disease springing up amongst a crew which had just been put into port, which evidently should never have happened. And I had to assume two things. And this, you know, the expeditionary work I've done and in the war and every place else, I've never seen any reason to break down. An absence of women brings about in men an aberration which expresses itself physically. And they get talking to one another, and they find out what a venereal disease should be, and they agree on its various manifestations. Because I found very few similarities amongst various cases of apparently the same kind of disease. It's very embarrassing to men in sailing ships and so on, very embarrassing to these fellows, to have venereal disease happen when they have had no contact with women at all. And I have seen that often enough in young boys that were as pure as the driven lily to understand completely that we didn't have here a germ at work. We had a series of ideas at work. Venereal disease is strongest in groups of men who are furthest from contact with women. Immediately after re-stimulation by contact. Here we take a group of men, they have momentary contact with women, then they go off again, and you get some fantastic percentage of reaction. Some fantastic percentage. Now men sexually outflow. If they outflow too long, they will expect a woman to inflow. But a woman doesn't outflow. Hence, venereal disease. Fascinating subject in view of the fact that it's ruined as many lives down the decades and centuries as it has. Now, would this occur if we carefully put girls only in girls' schools and boys only in boys' schools? Will we get some sort of illness resulting? Yes, as a matter of fact, a checkup on this demonstrates that after they've been brought together for a festival for one day, with complete innocence, we get some interesting physical reactions on the part of the boys from the boys' school. Girls in a girls' school who are totally segregated get into a very interesting state with regard to boys, too. They run a big scarcity on men. And this scarcity finally expresses itself normally in a hatred or dislike or fear or embarrassment. And we get all of these various manifestations that we consider bad, whether they are disease or misemotions, based on an inability to make a clean-cut communication with. Therefore, things we can't talk about, which is why I just mentioned venereal disease, this is an example, are those most susceptible to aberration. The communication is so prohibited. You can't even talk about it. You don't even dare tell the captain. Best thing to do is stand there and collapse on watch, of course. Let the ship go on the rocks. That's how it did that on me one day. Hey, what made you think, I said, son, that you were the only one aboard who didn't have this? You better talk to the rest of the crew. They had been up in Alaska, and all Alaskan ports are interesting. Now, when you socially enter a great many prohibitions against communications, as in the second dynamic, when you socially prohibit a contact with the object, you'll get all sorts of interesting ideas. Fully as interesting as the ideas men in this society at this time have of women, and fully as interesting as the ideas men in this society, women in this society have of men. And boy, that's a wild set of variables. I think you'll agree with me right there. And because these variables are so wild, someone could come along, of course, like Sigmund, and say, well, that's the total cause. Well, he certainly had his finger on part of it. But he never described it. Aberration is caused by a cut communication with the mass. And is remedied by reestablished communication with the mass. And actually, as far as process CCH is concerned, that is all there is to it.
Where communication is cut, an aberration is almost certain to occur. A set of ideas, foreign to, invented, confused, upset, will take place. If I told you at this moment that you must under no circumstances touch the wall of this lecture room, and if I kept stressing this week after week, even though you knew it was a gag, sooner or later you'd have a funny idea of these walls. And at long last, you wouldn't even be able to see these walls if it was really punched home hard. And how would we undo that piece of mismagic? We would simply ask you to look at the walls. And when you looked at the walls enough, you would have found they were there. Now, supposing I told you about some ruins which were dug up in the basement of this building, but which have been covered up now, which demonstrated a peculiar kind of germ, which, when it entered the skin, caused lumps. Oh, and I went on and on and on about these ruins and about these germs. And if I hoped sporadically while telling you this that the germs wouldn't be able to get through the concrete, and if Dick made it utterly against the law for any ACC student to go down in the basement, you have the exact operation which would have occurred at the beginning of any aberration or illness or physiological misconstruction. Maybe it's there, but you certainly had the idea it was there, and then you weren't permitted to communicate with it, and the ne plus ultra is you mustn't tell anybody that you have been prohibited from observing it. Make it confidential. Look what they're doing with the A-bomb. This is one of the silliest things you ever saw in your life. They don't know what they're looking at. The best of them don't know what they're looking at. None of them ever go down and stare at a piece of plutonium. And then they make everything about it confidential, secret, restricted. And nobody must be let in on it. And I can tell you that out of that combination, just as it would be in venereal disease, so can you make a broad spread illness. And there's possibly no more illness to radiation than that. Ah, the body is convinced, you say. Oh, no, no, the person who runs the body is convinced that when the little wiggle waggles go through you and leave holes, that you count on a meter thereafter, in spite of the fact that none of the stuff stays in you. This is fascinating. I mean, every way you look at this whole subject of explosion by radiation, of an atmosphere haunted by little mollusquingas, you just got a bunch of stuff. But it would add up to aberration. And it would add up to illness. The formula for creating an illness is to establish a terminal. Get everybody convinced that this terminal is there. Preferably without ever showing it to them. Then refuse to let them communicate with it. And then refuse to let them talk about having been prohibited. And the natural consequence of this will be that these people will assume they have to protect themselves from it. I don't care what it is. So we get the other mechanism that's a shortcut, and that is defend. Now, Johnny, don't go too near those light towers. You stay away from those light towers. You protect your body. Don't let your body get over there next to those 10,000 volts. Yes, you say, but any human body that you throw in to this network of wires will, of course, go up in smoke. Certainly it will.
He's been taught that for a long time. Touch high voltage current, you get a now I'm supposed to go up in smoke. It's as simple as that. It's a well-learned lesson. Protect yourself from automobiles. Why, automobiles kill you. Automobiles are dangerous. So when you drive one, you have to kill yourself with it.
See, at that first moment that Johnny is given a car, he's already been taught that he must stay away from automobiles in some fashion. Now he's in a car driving one. He has violated this, hasn't he? And he's been taught that violation of these ordinances against contacting automobiles will result in his death. So the violation occurs the moment he slides behind the wheel and he kills himself. What's simpler? The perfect setup. You can miss it. Now, one of the dangerous things to do with Scientology would be to put it under the counter. Why? In the first place, it isn't a terminal. The terminal, however, must be maintained, and access to that terminal must be preserved. And it mustn't be put on confidential, any part of it. Why? Because it's already dynamite. You can do anything with it that can be done with anything.
All right, so that's pretty high potential. Now let's not cut a line to it. And let's not put it beyond reach. There'd be a certain fatality in doing that. Once it exists, there's now a certain fatality in cutting it off. And yet every group that has ever learned a series of great truths has inevitably gone into a secret priesthood concerning them. Which was, of course, a destructive action. Now I'll show you how this shows up here. In the HCHPA course, we're going to teach hand contact mimicry. I noticed their command sheet today, and the command sheet said, after you did this with the hand, you said, all right, now put your hands in your lap. You know, that's just vaguely questionable. If you want to be on the safe side, never tell a preacher to break a communication as a defined or selected out action. Running 8C superiorly, it's a little harder to run this way because the control factor suffers and some other factors suffer. To make this then up for adjustment, you wouldn't ever tell the preacher to let go of the wall. Got that? Don't touch the wall. Then you'd say, do you see that wall over there? Well, he's still touching the wall. Well, you just leave it up to God and somebody else letting him let go of the wall. Now, that's what's known as very puristic auditing. That is pushing it to the absolute extreme. Because in 8C, he's touching enough walls to be able to let go of some. You can get away with it, you see. You can tell him to let go of a wall. I'm telling you that's wrong. But I am telling you that it's not purely, actually, inevitably, and completely a pure process. All the way upscale. If you want him to be acquainted with the wall, as swiftly as possible, you would have him touch the wall, you'd never have him let go. It's letting go of walls that got him in trouble. It isn't jumping into 10,000 volts of current that electrocutes the man. That isn't what electrocuted him. It's having so many times in the past disconnected from electricity when confronted with it. Every time you disconnect, you, to that degree, lower your own tolerance and so forth. Another thing. Now, you have to build up with many ideas any of these dangerous areas or dangerous things. You have to really garland the terminal to make it have very much kick. To a stove, you have to add heat. To a man, you have to add mystery. To a light pole, you have to add some current. There's got to be some somethingness, some something otherness that is also there as well as the mass. But only a person who is no longer able to tolerate mass will then fail to tolerate the electricity. Obviously, the electricity flying through these poles is more real to the individual being a line than the actual terminal of a pole. Why is it more real to him and his body? Because it has the greatest effect of him and his body. He could touch that pole, couldn't he, without becoming electrocuted or without any harm. He could touch the pole. But he can't touch the juice. That tells you there must be some terrific reality about the dangerousness of this juice, and the pole is either in apathy or non-existent or it isn't there, but it's not all that real. Or his acquaintance with the pole is so common that he no longer fears communication with the pole. Therefore, you can only teach one thing to a bricklayer, horribly enough, that is, you can, on your own initiative, communicate with it. You can communicate with it. As the one condition surrounding any mass. But how about it if mass is dropped out entirely? And then you ask him, now, can you communicate with that? He is so restrained, he is so protective, he is so withdrawn inside this universe. This whole universe is so dangerous, and he's protecting his body so extremely against this, and he's doing all of these various things. And you say, can you communicate with this? And you point to the wall, and he says, what? Or he says, on a social response, oh, yeah, the wall. Nothing there, sure, I can communicate with it. Get the idea? So we combine the fact that an existing mass must exist before we can make a communication with it. Now, therefore, the communication with the mass, it's the only thing we can do for him, but we have to have the mass. Now, in view of the fact that not many masses are handy, we use the creativeness of the preclear himself in order to furnish this mass. Because that's where it came from, where he was concerned in the first place, anyway. So we've now run up just three things. The first of those things, the only thing we can get him to do, you get the idea that I'm using do in a technical sense here, do, make an action. We can get him to do. The only thing you can get him to do is communicate with it. He will do that. The creation of mass is not necessarily a doing this. It's an isness. He doesn't do a creation of mass. This is what destroys painters. They're always trying to do a painting. You know, there's... they're creating a painting with various doingnesses. That's quite weird. You take a being that could mock up a picture, whole cloth, flap, and you're going to put a com lag into this creativeness, huh? It's about all it amounts to. All right, so we can get him to conceive of the isness, and we can get him to communicate with it. And by this, he will change his mind concerning its existence. He will change his mind concerning its conditions. But most particularly, and more importantly to you, he will change his mind with regard to its abundance or scarcity, and therefore its importance. It's the scarcity and abundance of things which denotes their value or importance. Value and importance are determined by scarcity and abundance. When something is too scarce, it is too valuable. When it is too scarce, it isn't. A fellow who has lived out in the plains, he's never been in the house all of his life, has a horror of walls. Do you know that? He used to give my
My grandfather used to laugh like that, and my grandmother used to be very prim about the whole thing. Some old woodsman or frontiersman had come in, you know. Some friend of my grandfather's, he'd come out on the ranch. They'd offer him the guest bedroom or something like this. Guys, inevitably, summer or winter, rain or lightning, they'd be very courteous, just the soul of courtesy about the whole thing, and then drag their traps out the window and run out and lie down under the chaparral. I couldn't stand walls. Just very upsetting for them. Their courtesy, however, would not permit them to refuse the hospitality. So my grandfather was always careful that the guest bedroom, or one of the three or four guest bedrooms, always had large windows that you could get a saddle through easily, and you didn't have to step down very far, because he was a hospitable man, too. They never had a wall, but they knew what walls were, and the scarcity of the wall not only made the wall scarce, but made it dangerous. A man who has lived too long without women will consider women dangerous. First he begins to revere them, and then he gets embarrassed in front of them, and then he can't talk to them, and the next thing he says is the most dangerous things alive. They never did anything to him, but they're very dangerous. It's quite remarkable. Most of your women preclears that tell you how horrible their husband was just haven't been married often enough in this life. They haven't very many husbands. There's a scarcity of them, or they had a hard time getting married, or their husband didn't stay home often enough. They certainly had a scarcity of one person, as well as a scarcity of the condition of that person. So scarcities and abundances do declare the final state of one's reaction to anything. And when something becomes very, very scarce, it is because one has cut communications. And that action of cutting communications is the same action as defending or protecting self. Now, as I say, you can break out of this. You can have this tremendous resurgence. You can actually look at the wall. You can actually throw something. You can handle. You can outflow. You can act. And then thus break through these barriers. And that sometimes happens to a person in life suddenly. And he gets one of these tremendous resurgences. And that's all there is behind one of these resurgences, by the way. There aren't any other factors. Or you as an auditor can bring him gently and quietly up on a gradient scale until he can communicate again with the objects in his environment. And he again will experience the same thing he experienced when he did this tremendous outflow. We're reaching toward the same goals. But we're saying, by communication, we establish the isness of existence. And by doing that, why, we make people well. Thank you.